Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we have a really great guest coming. His name is Ed Moy. He was the director of the U.S. Mint under Bush and Obama. There's only been one director in between him since then. And he is very knowledgeable on what's going on with world currencies and geopolitical situations. He's been an advocate of cryptocurrencies since at least for as long as I've known him, which is about 3 years now. And he really likes the democratization of cryptocurrencies and what that can do for the world. He's really an advocate of blockchain as well, because it can do the same thing as far as pushing decisions down to the people. And so we talk about that and what the governments, how they're going to perceive cryptocurrencies, how China perceives cryptocurrencies, which you'll find very interesting. You need to stay and listen to that. And how we can use blockchain to eliminate corruption, eliminate really bad corruption around the world, and shine a bright light on the people who are doing corruption. Yeah, I know you're going to look at the other part of that, and you're going to say, you know, government control and all those things, but you got to listen to him because I love talking to him. I think his heart's in the right place, and he's trying to do things that'll really benefit humanity. And at one point, I got goosebumps on what he was saying as far as ending corruption. I got to tell you, I'm thankful for that, because I've been covering Haiti and I've been covering some of these other things where the corruption is so awful that it actually made me sick. And so hearing some solutions that can actually solve some of those problems is something we really need to hear. So I welcome him coming. So I don't want to waste much more time, and let's get into the interview that I had with Ed Moy. Hi, Ed. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, Sarah, it's so good to be back with you.
I love talking to you, so I'm glad that you took this interview.
I really like your format, because it, unlike shows where I'm on for 3 minutes and it's all bullet points, you actually get to discuss things here, and that's a format that I really like.
Well, it gives people so much better information, which is, and to think about it. Mm-hmm. And you have so much that we could get from you. Well, let's dive into a couple really important subjects. Gold and silver seem vastly undervalued, and based on demand. How are prices able to stay so low when demand is so high?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's two things that are going on here. One is demand is actually slowing down. Even though gold and silver prices are fairly near their all-time highs, they've been going down slightly, and the demand for the gold and silver is down slightly. So the World Gold Council put out its third quarter report, and year over year, third quarter gold sales are about 10% lower than last year.
Oh, okay.
Now, still, you're talking about 1,000 tons worldwide, which is still a lot of gold and much more than what happened before the financial crisis. But it's not close. It's close, but not that close to the peak sales during the financial crisis. So gold is still hot, but it's beginning to go down. And the focus of most of the sales are in countries that are really troubled. Like, one of the big factors behind third quarter sales was the economic recovery that's been going on in Turkey. Mm-hmm. And once people are getting a little bit more money, and after the inflation and the deposit they had with their banks, people are using their newfound economic wealth to buy gold.
Okay.
Well, so that's one big factor. But the other factor that I find is really interesting is the huge growth in options, derivatives, futures in gold trading. And so, for example, when you look at all the gold at COMEX, to give one example, for every ounce of gold, there are about 50 to 70 different futures contracts on them, both long and short. And so that 1 ounce of physical gold that gets traded back and forth is offset by 50 to 70 times that magnitude by what's going on in the paper trading. And that has a huge impact on what the gold prices are.
And that causes them to go down?
Well, right now, you have a lot of people that think that the world economy is slowly recovering, and therefore the demand for gold is likely to go down over time. And so you have a lot of short people out there that are betting that that price is going to go down low. And those are offsetting the ones that are betting long, thinking that it will go up. And so as a result, that's holding gold prices down.
Well, what about silver? Because silver is off its high quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also off its high in comparison to gold, because in the past it's been at a much closer ratio to gold. So what do you think about that? Do you think silver is undervalued?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question. If you take a look at the last 50 years on average, it takes about 50 ounces of silver to buy 1 ounce of gold. Today, gold is about $1,300. And silver is about 1730. And when you look at that ratio, it's like 1 to 75,
mm-hmm.
right? And so you have the question, there's two questions that come from that. Is gold overvalued or silver? So when you look at it, if you brought it down to the traditional ratio of 50 to 1, gold should either be in the $860 range or silver should be in the $26 range.
And what is your opinion on that?
Well, you know, I think that there's room for silver to grow.
Okay.
Yes, it could be a good investment. I don't know if it's an investment of a lifetime because silver, you know, if you apply this ratio and things eventually come out to an equilibrium of 50 to 1 and silver goes up to $26, that's a 50% increase, which is a pretty, you know, pretty healthy return. But when you take a look at Bitcoin, Bitcoin went from 1,100 to 5,700 since the beginning of this year. That's a 500% return. And if you look at Ethereum, which was probably, 25 cents at the beginning or not so long ago, and it's like $300 today, those seem to be pretty good speculative investments.
Yeah, so those are good. Now, you are really into cryptocurrencies. You've been into it for years, since the beginning almost, and you have been really trying to educate people on Bitcoin. And I had you on my show, and we talked about Bitcoin. This is almost 2 years ago now. So what is the geopolitical situation with cryptocurrencies? Do you foresee all governments putting out their own cryptocurrency, or do you see them embracing independent cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin?
Mm-hmm. Well, so as a politician, I can say, you know, that's a very complicated question, and there's a lot of complicated answers behind that. But, you know, bottom line is, one of the things that give a nation identity is their currency. And so as a result, I don't see nations ever ceding that authority to the private sector. Right? But saying that, there are a lot of advantages to cryptocurrencies, and I see nations as they transition from less paper, you know, less physical currency use to more electronic.
Mm-hmm.
I also see them changing from electronic to more digital. And so how I define the difference is electronic is your standard proprietary electronic highways that the government Federal Reserve has, all the banks have with each other, and whenever you use those highways, you pay a fee, right? Wire charges, for example. What I define as digital is anything that goes over the internet. So the costs go down dramatically. And what cryptocurrencies have proved is that you can transfer value over the internet in a very secure basis. And I think governments are really interested in that. But the offsetting part here is what gives a lot of cryptocurrencies value is there's a limit to how much cryptocurrency is out there. And then the market then influences that value by exchange trading to figure out what how customers price it all out. Whereas governments are used to having fiat currency, legal tender, where they end up saying, we don't care what the market says, a dollar is always going to be worth a dollar, and you have to accept it as a dollar. And then there's a little bit of trading going on through foreign exchange, but generally there's nothing backing the currencies except the government promise, whereas cryptocurrencies are valued because the market sees that there's some value in it.
Well, are countries liking that? I mean, because they like to control. They don't like change. They've created a whole method of controlling the economies. Are they going to accept that? And are different countries looking at it differently?
Yeah, I think different countries are looking at it differently. One of the things that, one grid that I use, very simple four-quadrant grid, advanced countries and developing countries and Bitcoin as or cryptocurrencies as currency or cryptocurrencies as technology, platforms. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you take a look at it from that perspective, in developed countries, generally they have money that works. In the United States, we can depend generally on a credit card working or a debit card, payment cards, as well as wire transfers and checking and cash. Those things work for us. And so there's very little need for something like Bitcoin in the United States, other than people want to experiment or they have philosophical reasons for using it. In countries like Argentina or Venezuela, where their currency doesn't work, in those countries, there's increased demand from its citizens to find alternatives. And that's where cryptocurrencies being used as currency are growing in those countries. So then you put the flip hat on and you take a look at lesser developed countries, and you take a look at the technology. And here in the United States, because currencies generally work, there's a lot of interest in the United States to use the blockchain technology for other things, whereas in Ukraine, they're still struggling with money, and that's such a basic thing that that's what they're focused on. And blockchain doesn't really, they're not ready to take advantage of the advances of blockchain technology.
Well, cryptocurrencies backed by blockchain is vastly more secure than,
yes,
I mean, it's like the difference of having money in a brown paper bag versus in a safe. I mean, it's big difference. So from that standpoint, they're interested in it, I'm assuming. But as far as letting it actually flourish and not have their own, do you foresee the United States ever allowing Bitcoin to get to that point, or Ethereum or any other one?
Yes. So, I don't see in the United States, at least in the short term, over the next couple of years or even midterm, over the next decade or so, Bitcoin as a currency or other cryptocurrencies making any significant dent in how the dollar is used here. But I do see tokens that are created through these cryptocurrencies growing. One of the hot markets right now is what's called ICOs, or initial coin offerings. Mm-hmm. They're basically a cross between an initial public offering and crowdfunding. And so a lot of companies are beginning to develop their own cryptocurrencies based on blockchain technology, but basically selling those tokens for money, and people then trade those tokens back and forth depending on how they think the company is going to do. So in essence, it's a little bit like a stock offering. Mm-hmm. And the SEC recently said, this is really interesting. We actually view this as a security, and as a result, we're going to be taking a closer look on how to regulate this over the next couple of years.
Interesting.
And so it's that level of legitimacy.
That's interesting, because it can change the whole way stocks are done.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And this could be a way to go beyond just crowdfunding to more accountable investing. Mm-hmm. right? But not quite the same as a stock. So somewhere in between, but closer to a stock.
Interesting.
So just to give you an example, so, you know, so when Bitcoin came out, then there was Litecoin, Dogecoin, Darkcoin, a couple others, but it really was a fairly small universe. Today, and most of this growth has happened in last year, there are 900 different cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've even heard more than 1,000. Yeah, it's and probably there's so many that you just don't even know because they're so small that so few people are using them.
Yes. Yep. I totally agree. And when you take a look at some of the offerings that they've had through these ICOs, and you read their prospectus, in my opinion, it doesn't even come close to meeting the scrutiny that a legitimate investor would demand. These white papers that are written are, in essence, 2 or 3 pages long. The companies don't have revenue. They basically have an idea, and they try to sell their coin. And so I think that's this early stage, and a lot of those are going to get washed out. But over time, the ones that begin to behave more like a regulated security that would meet SEC scrutiny, those are the ones that I think will survive over time.
Well, it sounded like the tech bubble. That's what those companies were doing back then, remember? They had nothing, and they were like a $1 billion valuation. So, right. So China really made a hard hit on Bitcoin recently when they shut down those exchanges. Can you explain that and what China's view is on that?
Yeah. So I think, from where I sit, and I don't have any inside information on China, but, I've done business there. I'm Chinese myself. So reading the tea leaves, what I see China doing is, when you take a look at the formal government, it's basically a centralized form of government. And you take a look at any cryptocurrency, it's in essence a decentralized currency, right? And so those two things don't mix. And the government, the Chinese government, how they control their own currency is critical to how they grow their economy. And they can't afford to have any leakage of people using other currencies. And that's why China has so many capital controls, so many restrictions, et cetera, on the use of money in China. So it's really interesting that 2 years ago, China clamped down on Bitcoin use because it was popping up all over the place. I was in this faraway city in a interior province with no Western influence, and the noodle house owner was accepting payment in Bitcoin. Oh. And so, so somehow they got access to that. And when the Chinese government figured out that this is could be widespread, they ended up clamping down on the use of Bitcoin and declared it a commodity that would be regulated by the Chinese Commodity Agency, which is the most restrictive and regulated entity. So my guess is China wanted to stop it from growing, but wanted to at least have a laboratory to see how it worked, to figure out what things they could either use from it or whether it was good for their own economy, et cetera, et cetera. And I think now they've come to the conclusion they don't like Bitcoin because it restricts their influence and power over their own currency. And they're still studying it because I think and if you take a look at a lot of Bitcoin growth, it's a lot of Bitcoin's being mined in China. And so from that, my conclusion is China does not want Bitcoin to hurt their own country, but they don't mind Bitcoin hurting other people's countries.
They actually kind of like it. I could see that. It becomes a financial weapon, I would think.
Yes. I think they're looking at it as another tool in their economic arsenal.
Interesting. So they want it to be popular here in the United States because then we can't control our currency.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then they can manipulate things how they want.
I think that's one theory.
It's hard to really know, right? Well, yep. But Cryptocurrencies do have a really great place in underdeveloped countries where they don't have access to banking.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's where I think the potential growth is for cryptocurrencies. Already in countries like Kenya, you're seeing things like the M-Pesa develop just from the market because there's a need. And you know, a lot of that initial early trading happened because when you're in a, say, a sub-Saharan country where they don't have their own mint and it's very expensive to hire out to another mint to make your currency and then have it shipped to you. And then, you know, it's hot, it's humid. So bills don't last the 18 months that they do here in the United States. They might last 3 months. You know, it gets to be a very expensive proposition. And the physical currency is very difficult to keep at a usable level. So what ends up happening is in Kenya, Somalia, Ethiopia, these telecom companies end up giving you credits for using their services. And you can either use those credits to reduce your bill or to buy additional services. And people have learned that they can trade credits among family. Well, why can't they trade with their retailer? And so there's been this growth because the market has figured this out, where people use these telecom credits as pseudo cash. So when you buy five yams, you know, you give two credits from Verizon, which is equal to one credit from AT&T, et cetera, et cetera. They've worked out their own exchange rate in lieu of any cash being readily available.
Well, and this allows so much more business to go on. But now what do banks think of this? Because this really eliminates the need for banks to be involved in every transaction, because we can then put money, and it's not just cryptocurrencies. There's software that lets us transfer money back and forth without a middle bank involved. Yeah. What are banks thinking of this? I mean, do you foresee banks really pushing back and not and doing whatever they can to keep their market share?
Yeah, I think you're already seeing it with Jamie Dimon at JPMorgan Chase coming out about a month ago saying Bitcoin is basically tulips. There's nothing there, and you know, it's all fake. But he will also, if you push him, he will say that JPMorgan is looking into blockchain as far as how it can help their bank out with keeping track of transactions and reducing back office costs. And so, you know, typically when large oligopolies are confronted with losing market share, they're going to use the regulations and legal mechanisms through laws to try to keep their market share while they figure out how to exploit it.
Exactly. So
exploit that technology themselves. And when they're ready to then unveil it, then, you know, so these you know, basically crony capitalism ends up protecting what they have until they've taken advantage of that technology and can do it better themselves.
Well, but there is a matter of time before having a middleman between money is going to go away to a certain extent, right?
Yep.
Because if you don't need it and it just builds costs into the system, then I think eventually it will go away once we can figure it out.
Yeah. So, you know, this is the dilemma that big banks have, right? They make money by investing depositors' money. And depositors are individuals just like you and I. But the cost of keeping us is really high. You know, checking costs money. Every time we go, they have to keep all these retail outlets for us. What they're trying to figure out is, how can we reduce the costs of individuals but yet keep their money? So if we end up taking a portion of that money out because we don't need them anymore, because we can hold money in an electronic wallet and transfer it to our Amazon purchase without using the bank, then the bank has less money to invest. And so that's why you see this growth of online banking. They're trying to figure out a way to dramatically reduce the cost of taking care of you and I, but yet keeping our deposits so they can play with them.
That's exactly what's going to happen. They're going to end up having all the depositories of this, even though it looks like we can go directly back and forth between people. We're really going to be going back and forth through these software depositories. They're going to really reduce their costs, yet I think that's probably, at least in the midterm, that's probably what's going to happen.
Yep. So the only caveat to that, and here's where I think the future is very intriguing, is over time, there's more and more decentralization. And so with that, market choices, improvement in technologies, the market will eventually speak, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, they may be able to control or restrict the market through regulatory action for a while, but eventually the market always wins. And I think people are going to want multiple choices, and they're going to, based on every transaction they make, they're going to weigh what is the most efficient and cost-effective way to do this particular transaction. Sometimes it's going to be a bank because we're going to need mortgages, and other times we're going to ignore the bank because we don't want the checking fee or the credit card fee.
Well, so now knowing that, the market's going to eventually decide what we're going to do. Do you think the World Bank and the powers that be, when it comes to money, are they going to be comfortable with letting the market decide the money, even though that's supposedly our philosophy? Are they going to be comfortable with that, knowing China is going to be competing with us on a different playing field?
Mm-hmm. So that's a really good question. And I would point you to, you know, so I've dealt with the Fed, which was my customer when I was director of the Mint, and have a relationship with several central banks, as well as I know the World Bank and the IMF. And the bottom line is they're very conservative, not politically, but they're very cautious organizations that are almost like academic institutions. Mm-hmm. And recently I was at the IMF, and Christine Lagarde came out and said, there is a future for cryptocurrencies in this world. That's a really big statement from one of those major institutions to be able to say that. In particular, I was there because one of the companies that I advise won the James Wolfensohn Award as far as being the disruptor of corruption in world financial aid. And they're, the IMF has embraced blockchain technology as one of their futures to significantly reduce corruption in foreign aid and foreign relief.
Well, yeah, because we have, like I said, it's in a paper bag versus being protected at all.
Absolutely. And there's a wide recognition that anywhere from 10 to 40% of all foreign aid ends up not getting to the place where it's supposed to be because of a lot of hands in the middle.
Well, we also have an issue where we have the bad guys. I mean, and they've already made the leap to be a real bad guy, you know, doing organs or whatever else they're doing. They have no problem fronting as a charity organization. Mm-hmm. And so we have bad guys doing that. And it's hard to, for us to know. You know, they'll do anything. If they're going to do that, they'll do anything.
Yes. That's right. That's right. They've already broken some moral barrier there that won't prevent them from these other things.
Yeah, the moral barrier they broke was way worse than just act, you know.
Yes.
So, okay, well, I have some other questions for you when it comes to China, because, you know, China's a big deal when it comes to what we're going to do worldwide and how the future is going to go. A lot of people are talking that China's currency is going to end up being the world's currency. Do you foresee that happening?
I don't. I think the world economy is complex enough that there's not going to be, this is not post-World War II, where the United States was the only surviving major economy. And everyone wanted to buy U.S. goods. And so the easy answer was to make the U.S. dollar the world's reserve currency. We're not at that place anymore in the world, unless another catastrophic thing happens. I think China does want legitimacy, and they recently were approved to be one of the currencies included in the special drawing rights SDR of the IMF, which is kind of a badge of honor, and it increases the prestige of their currency. But even then, China has had some problems making sure that their currency is widely used around the world. It's one thing to have banks being willing to accept it, right, around the world, which is part of what the special drawing rights does. But it's another one that people actually want to use it. And what they've actually seen over the course of the last couple of years is the use of the Chinese currency has actually gone down year over year.
And what are they? What's replacing it?
Well, it's the dollar, the euro, the yen, okay. So part of it is the reason why you want foreign currency is you want to buy that country's products. And when you look at China, China's economy has slowed. So it's probably will grow at 6.5-6.7% this year, which is a far cry from 10 or 12. 5 years ago, they've been last year was the lowest economic growth in 25 years. China now is beginning to turn inward because they're realizing that their economy can't depend on the rest of the world buying their stuff. And so they're trying to develop their economy into a consumer economy like the United States is, and trying to get Chinese citizens to basically buy Chinese-made products. And that's how they're going to stabilize and then grow their economy. And so as a result, unlike America needing to buy Chinese goods and therefore needing Chinese currency in order to do that, the demand is incrementally going down over time.
But even with the 6.7% increase in growth, they are growing at a much faster clip than we are. Does that pose a threat for us? Or is it because we are already so big, our growth, they need to grow just to even compete?
Yes, they need to grow to even just compete with us. So China is growing from a, they have a much larger population than we do. And that population makes much less per capita than we do. But because of all the people and what they're making, you multiply that all up and their GDP is equal, if not slightly surpassing our GDP. So that's where people say, China is the next growing economy. So if China was able to grow it to the point of where as prosperous as where America is, then they would be three times bigger than what the U.S. economy is. And that's their goal. But what they figured out is they need to grow their own internal consumers in order to make that happen. And so in China, in order to keep the populace happy, they need to focus on at minimum 7% growth, to keep the peace, because China really is a very diverse country with many different populations, many different ethnic groups, many different languages, but they're all united under this dream that the government can make lives better for them. And when the economy starts slowing is when you start getting social unrest in China. Take a look at all the labor strikes that they've had and miners, going off the job and in protest. That has all happened recently because the economy is slowing down and there's fewer options for people to earn income. And so China needs that growth. And their big problem is in order to get that growth, they've used government stimulus in the form of credit. And credit is way out of control in China. Mm-hmm. And there's no guarantee that those the people who borrowed are going to be able to pay it all back.
Yeah, so that's a potential future problem. But how much growth does the United States need before it has social unrest?
Yes. So, we're at a new, what people would argue is a new normal, which is between 1 and 1.5% growth. If you look at current economic theory, growth is a function of population that's working and productivity. And productivity has flattened out, and we have record numbers of people not participating in the workforce. And so we're stuck at, 1 or 1.2% growth. In America, if we grew at between 3 and 4%, and we're going to hit the first 3% quarter here in the United States very soon. If you do that, a lot of our fiscal problems go away.
And a lot of our unrest will start to settle down. Because we can really see, and I've talked to people who think that, the unrest that we're seeing is really an economic situation showing up in all different ways.
Yeah, I would mostly agree with that. I would say that the economic situation is a big driver of a lot of the unrest that we have. And I think, frankly, that's one of the things that propelled Donald Trump into the presidency. Mm-hmm. There was a huge role reversal this last election. When you look at the traditional Democratic base that was really pioneered by FDR during the Depression, he figured out what was going on. He said, a lot of fat cats on Wall Street have recovered from the Depression, but there are a lot of forgotten people that are still hurting. And those are people that I'm running for president because I want to have a new deal with them where I can give them jobs, even if they're government jobs and all this other stuff. And so Roosevelt basically campaigned on a forgotten man. And today, I think Donald Trump has campaigned on the behalf of the forgotten man. And the Democrats have turned into the party of elitism, where Hillary Clinton's hanging around with celebrities, and you got Katy Perry doing rallies for them, and they're campaigning for transgender bathrooms and things like that. When you take a look at the average person in the United States, they may or may not care about those issues, but what they care about more is whether or not they have a good job.
Well, yeah, because they don't want to work 18 hours a day and then still be able to barely pay for food on the table.
Absolutely. Yep,
I mean, all the other issues become really low priority when you're dealing with those kind of things.
Yep, yep. And I think that's why one of the main reasons why Trump won. And I think you're right that this this new normal of 1% growth in the United States leaves a lot of people out of that recovery.
Well, now, one thing that worries me about China is China seems to be focusing on things the United States isn't. They seem to be focusing more on their community development, seem to be more, they don't spend as much on military, so their resources can go towards developing up their culture, developing up their resources, their foundations, whereas we aren't using those resources to develop our schools, our infrastructure, our things that are really important.
So, the big difference here is China's government is more centralized. And so the power comes to just a very few people that can make critical decisions without having a messy debate about it. Mm-hmm. In the United States, we are a representative democracy for all the good and bad that is. And right now, there's a lot of gridlock because there's a lot of disagreement. And so that slows down our ability to solve some of these big problems. So China doesn't have that issue because, their elections are pretty much rigged, and they end up having, the leaders that the government wants next, and those leaders have enough power to make those decisions. So, the good and bad of that is the good is if your economy is relatively underdeveloped, there's a lot of room for improvement, you can make the types of decisions to get your economy going. And China's done that. No one can argue the economic miracle of taking 200 to 300 million people out of poverty mm-hmm. and putting them into the middle class. There's not been a single greater economic migration in the world in our history, and so that is a huge, huge accomplishment. But what they're also realizing is the nine people that make up the Politburo, they can't micromanage the trillions of decisions that are being made in the market every single day. And as a result, there are limits, in my opinion, to this, I think it's an oxymoron, but it's described as state capitalism. You know, it's state controlled and driven and governed capitalism. And so I think there are eventual limits to that. And what you're seeing is with this decline of economic growth in China, state capitalism might have been good in organizing your economy at the very beginning. But once the economy reaches a certain level of sophistication, no individual or group of individuals can manage that to the end result that they're looking for.
Because it's just too complex, too many things that you have to do. Just not possible.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And they're trying, and with all the stimulus, they might have reversed it from 6.5% being the all-time low in the last 25 years of economic growth. And they might, after 4 years of huge stimulus and money risk, they've increased it from 6.5 to 6.7. It's still not 10. It's still not 12. And so I think we're seeing the limits of what a state-run capitalist system can do.
And they should be higher because they're underdeveloped in a lot of areas.
Yes.
That's
most
the
of
issue.
Most happen in urban areas, not in most of the country, which is rural.
Okay, now, you know, when you have major issues like we have, you know, some people say an enlightened dictator is the best thing to have. The problem is what you're articulating so well is that you can't really, I love what you're saying here, is, you know, the opposite of that, you can, obviously, getting an enlightened dictator is very difficult and very risky and doesn't happen very often. But when you have, even if you do have an enlightened dictator, you run into that wall what China's running into.
Yes. You know, and bottom line is, I believe that humans are not perfect. And so you can't have a perfect person. Even the most benevolent person has their flaws.
Absolutely.
And eventually those flaws will catch up. And the reason why I love democracy, even though it's a messy process, is that flaws are discovered and flaws are overcome and new people are elected. And there's always that constant dynamism that eventually wins the day.
But there are some things we can do to better our situation and how we're structured. And, you know, when we first set this up, the number of representatives to people were something like 1 to 7,000 or something. And now it's like 1 to 1,000,000. So the representatives are so far away from the people compared to what it was when we founded the country. So, you know, maybe there's some things that we need to change in order for our country to really represent people, because the facts show that they're not doing what the people are asking them to do.
Yeah. So here's where, you know, bring us back to our original topic of blockchain. I think blockchain can offer a lot of potential solutions here. Being able to everybody have their unique ID, then if a representative wanted to know what their constituents thought about a particular issue, people could vote right then and there, right? And they would have instant feedback of what the vast majority of their constituency wanted. You know, none of this, I can't touch 1,000,000 people, but I represent them. So I believe I was elected because they like my ideas and therefore I'm going to stick with my ideas. Now I can actually let citizens have a direct input into policy decisions.
Which would be so great, because right now it's just not possible for them to be able to understand what 1,000,000 people want. And 1,000,000 people don't really, I mean, you just don't know. And so they're listening to lobbyists and other people who are in their ear a lot more than the people they represent.
Absolutely.
And it could start to balance that out.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, the great thing about this decentralized technology is it brings more power to the most basic, broadest levels possible.
Yeah, I love that. So now what are you doing now? As far as, because I know this has really been something you've been championing for a while, the cryptocurrencies, blockchain. So many things have happened since we talked last. So what are you doing now as far as getting this out and getting the word out on what we should be doing?
That's a really good point, Sarah. So I have focused a lot of initiatives on companies that I believe can really move the needle and change things. And, I'll just give you one example, which I mentioned before, a company called Aid Tech, AIDTECH. And what they are doing is developing, using the blockchain to have unique digital IDs that they give to recipients of foreign aid or foreign relief. And so when a government says, we're going to give X amount to this country because of an earthquake, and that money needs to go to these people that are hurting, that money can only get to those people, and we get rid of all the middlemen, and there's no a possibility of corruption because the money goes from the U.S. government right into the individual's hands that they need. Or we send them a token, for example, if they need food, and there's no natural disaster, but we want to feed people who are malnourished, we can send them tokens. And those tokens can be redeemed for only these things at these grocery stores, and that's how you spend it. And so we absolutely can make sure that 100% of our money gets to the people that need it, and those people spend it only on the things that are authorized for them to spend it.
Well, that would be excellent, because as you know, in Haiti, we had a complete nightmare, and they still
absolutely
haven't.
Yeah,
it's a humanitarian disaster, what happened over there. And so something like this could be absolutely incredible. Of course, there's going to be additional issues that come with this, and then we have to solve some of that. But every time, if you can make a huge leaps of improvements, because right now we really have a mess on our hands.
Yes, a mess worldwide. And the traditional method, and you know, I think a lot of people who end up funding these efforts are getting frustrated. People who've given to organizations that are supposed to help with Puerto Rican relief find out that, it's a fake front and people ran off with the money, or they end up taking 95% of the money in management costs and 5% eventually gets somewhere over there. This brings transparency. It brings accountability. And gosh, miracle of miracles, the money actually gets to where it needs to be.
I actually got goosebumps right then, because I've been covering a lot of these issues. And that was the first time I really felt like hopeful that we could solve some of these problems, because I'm serious, because it's been the Haiti thing was so demoralizing to cover for me. And to know that there's a light, a beacon of some kind of solution that we can do that can change it, that we never have something like that again, And I can see how people who are trying to do something with their hard-earned money are just disillusioned, seeing that it's not going to what it's supposed to be going to.
Yeah. Well, Haiti was a big example of 2 weeks ago. I was at the International Monetary Fund, it was the culmination of a project that they were working on with Citibank. And the IMF and James Wolfensohn was there. He was the first major leader, financial leader, that used the C word, and that was corruption. As a result, Citibank named a top anti-corruption award after him. And what they ended up doing is sponsoring this tech contest. And they said, basically, any company out there can compete. We want ideas to eliminate corruption in foreign aid and foreign relief. 1,900 companies came up with ideas, of which Citibank and the IMF and a number of other judges narrowed down to the top ideas, which all got awards, and then the best of the best of those ideas, which was this company called Aid Tech. So I say that because there's a lot of thinking going on here, and these new breakthroughs in technology are beginning to shine light where there was never light before, and inspiring these new solutions to come up. So I think we're just in the beginning of the cusp of what technology can do. And there's a lot of interest now in how to leverage that technology to eliminate some of these problems. So I would be hopeful.
Well, and then we can get rid of, some of these bad guys being in spots. They just can't get away with it anymore. The light is too bright. They just can't get away with it. And, there may be 20%, 21% of the people are psychopaths or something, the light would be so bright that the rest of us would make sure that they couldn't do anything.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know?
Yeah. And so this is not only with private organizations that are helping out in Haiti, but this is, this can get right to USAID or the Millennium Challenge Corporation. We want to know where our federal dollars are going. And when we want to build a bridge in a foreign country, we want to know that money went to the bridge and not to a bunch of people who took it off the top and there's not enough money to build a bridge, or the bridge that gets built ends up being a poor quality bridge because all the money that they needed was used to pay off other people in order to make the bridge.
Well, and the hard part of that is I can understand how people don't want to pay taxes when that's what's going on everywhere, you know?
Yes.
And so when you start seeing things go to what it's supposed to go to, then you're like, okay, I'm okay with paying taxes because things are getting done. But when things aren't getting done, it's really hard. And you understand the argument.
Yes. So you could be Madame Lagarde at the IMF because she made precisely that argument. She said that not only does corruption hurt the people that we're trying to help, but there are many other consequences, and one which is lessening of the public trust, mm-hmm. because we don't know, we don't want to pay our taxes, or we want to pay as few taxes as possible because we don't trust the government's going to use it very well. And so that's exactly the argument that she made 2 weeks ago. Very interesting.
Yeah, well, great. Well, at least we're in sync on that one. Well, I think it's just a very obvious, once you start thinking about it, it's very obvious that that, you know, the majority of the people want to be good people and want their things to go well. Yeah, we have a problem with 20% of our people. Maybe it's a little higher, maybe it's a little less, but the majority are decent people that want a good community for everyone. And the 20% seem to be winning a little bit right now. And so it's good to see that tide turning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, what these decentralized technologies allow to happen is democracy to happen at the individual level.
Yeah, excellent.
And we really did not have that capability before. And that's I think that's a brand new world that this type of technology allows.
That's why I love talking to you, because you see, you really make things clear and you understand how this stuff can really be ushered in to really make a difference in people's lives. Mm-hmm. So I love talking to you about this stuff.
Well, you know, and I admit I am spoiled. The different things that I do, I run across some of the most interesting, innovative people all around the world. And I have the benefit of gleaning all these ideas and seeing what's happened globally and trying to figure out what the new trends are. That's one of the things that energizes me.
Yeah, well, awesome. I can tell. So thank you so much. How can people get hold of you or read about you and see what you have going on?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I do have a website that I collect all my op-eds and articles and news appearances. That's edmoy, edmoy.com. You can also follow me at Twitter, at Edmund C. Moy, EdmundCMoy. Or you can email me directly at ed@edmoy.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Ed. And I hope you have an amazing day and we'll come back again.
So, Sarah, I have to make one observation here. When Fred Astaire was asked who was his favorite dance partner, and he said, I can't name my favorite dance partner. It'd be like saying, what's my favorite child? But I will tell you one thing. When you've danced with Sid Charisse, you stayed danced with. So when I get interviewed by Sarah Westall, I stayed interviewed.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. That's a high honor. Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Yep. Thanks. And look forward to being on your show again. Bye, Sarah.